I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Remembering 1968, first in a series, what made it the year of our lifetimes was the density of prophetic events and the sense that they were all somehow connected. From the David Beats Goliath Tet Offensive in Vietnam in these last days of January 50 years ago, to the autumn of Black Power salutes from the winning American sprinters in the Mexico City Olympics. A year of insights flashing, illusions bursting, hopes getting crushed in the martyrdom of Dr. King and Bobby Kennedy. Richard Nixon in office, Lyndon Johnson into exile, wasn't the end of imperial overreach. It felt more like a deepening, darkening of the American brand. The Tet Offensive in Vietnam triggered it. When the enemy insurrection broke out, the CBS News legend Walter Cronkite was heard to shout across his studio, "What the hell is going on? I thought we were winning this war." Vietnam, the helicopter war in Asia, was becoming the living room war in the U.S.
Hi, this is Johnny Carson. As you know, this is usual starting time for The Tonight Show, but because of the critical war situation in Vietnam, especially around Saigon, NBC for the next 15 minutes is going to bring you a special news program via satellite.
So NBC News presents Viet Cong Terror.
The new communist campaign in Vietnam continues.
Just of what was supposed to be the most secure city in Vietnam.
We knew this was coming. Our intelligence even pinpointed the exact day it would happen. What we did not know was where. This is the official story as given out by White House News Secretary.
Viet Cong guerrillas had penetrated the U.S. Embassy in Saigon and made a six-hour fight to hold it. And the gruesome back-and-forth battle of Hue was underway in Vietnam's old capital, a university town on the Perfume River, described by the great Michael Herr as the one really lovely city in the country. BC guerrillas had seized it by surprise. U.S. firepower over 3 weeks took it back by leveling the homes of most of its 130,000 people. Mark Bowden is the reporter best known for Black Hawk Down, the book that became the movie about U.S. Marines trapped in Somalia in 1993. From his new book, Hue, 1968, Mark Bowden gets us started on the Tet Offensive 50 years ago, and he says the most awful urban battlefield Americans had ever fought in. A miniature version of the war in Vietnam and a turning point in it.
Hue was kind of an island in the war. Because it was a religious center and an educational center, and because it held such historic importance in the history of Vietnam, it had been untouched for the most part by the fighting. And in fact, there were very few troops in Hue, either American or South Vietnamese. The city itself is only about 50 miles south of the demilitarized zone and the demarcation line at that time between North and South Vietnam. You know, it's a beautiful city. It has the Huang River, what the Americans called the Perfume River, ran right through the middle of it. And all of northern Hue is essentially this enormous fortress called the Citadel, which looks like something out of Game of Thrones, 30-foot high walls, 30, 50 feet thick with gates over the nine entrances and exits and a moat all around the outside. It encloses about 2 square miles, and there were about, I would say, maybe 70, 80,000 people who lived and worked inside the Citadel. And the southern part of the city on the other bank of the Huang River was the modern city, which had most of the big government buildings and Hue University. And it was, you know, a thriving, growing part of the whole city.
Mark, it was a surprise. The Americans knew something was up, but they thought it was going to be at Khe Sanh. Suddenly, the enemy was inside that citadel, and we barely recognized what was going on. Tell us what did happen and why. Westmoreland thought he'd been snookered. LBJ thought we'd won, and then the battle goes on for 3 weeks. Remind us.
Well, General Westmoreland was very convinced that he had a deep understanding of what was happening in South Vietnam, his battlefield. He had a lot of very sophisticated measures, data points that he used to track what he considered to be the mounting success of the American military effort. And his indicators told him that the enemy had been much reduced, that they were only capable of mounting small-scale ambush-style attacks on the furthest reaches of the country, out in the highlands or in the jungles, that they were not really a threat in the populated areas of South Vietnam. And he was very convinced of this. And so against that backdrop, you have a very determined North Vietnamese and Viet Cong effort to secretly amass an army of 10,000 in the outskirts of Hue City, arm them, equip them, and prepare them for a surprise attack on the eve of the holiday of Tet. So when they sprung their attack, they basically swept into the city, for the most part, unchallenged, and within hours occupied the third largest city in South Vietnam.
Your friend and mine, Gene Roberts, for the New York Times, one of the few people who seemed to grasp what was happening, wrote that at nightfall, the Marines held only two square blocks of the ancient city of Hue, a smoking city. Can you explain how William Westmoreland was so convinced of complete fantasy?
I can't. You know, I did speak to people who worked in intelligence for the American military who said there were plenty of indicators, and there were actually intelligence officers who did not share Westmoreland's rosy picture of what was happening in the country. But the general seemed to have a peculiarly strong ability to ignore information that contradicted what he preferred to believe. Yeah. We all meet people like this in life. And so he, I think, was taken completely by surprise. And in any war, the enemy is always capable of pulling off a surprise. But in this case, what I do fault Westmoreland for is his inability to recognize what had happened, or his refusal to recognize what had happened for many days after the city, in fact, had been taken. And I think that got a lot of young Americans killed.
3 weeks later, American firepower had smashed the city and owned the ruins in a way. Then came the fight over who won and what body counts meant after all. That, too, is a miniature of the Vietnam story.
It is. It's long been an argument by Vietnam veterans and the American military that they, in effect, won the war militarily. You know, that depends on how you define the war. In the case of the Battle for Hue, it is true that the Marines and the United States Army, over a period of 3 to 4 weeks, eventually took back the city. They destroyed 80% of it, and they killed not just them, but the battle itself killed well over 10,000 civilians. They proclaimed victory at that point because they rose their flag, or the flag of South Vietnam, over the citadel. But I think any effort to assess the overall impact of the event would have to conclude that the United States, I think, lost more than it gained.
What did it lose?
Well, it lost the confidence of the American people. Hmm. LBJ declined to run for another term within weeks after this battle ending. It altered the debate in this country completely. Prior to the Tet Offensive and the Battle of Hue, the argument was always over how long it would take to win the war and what we would need to commit in order to win the war. And then the debate just shifted completely to how do we get out of Vietnam? The public support for the war, which had, I think, been mainstream and remained strong for some time after the Tet Offensive, nevertheless began to erode significantly after the Tet Offensive. The anti-war movement in this country had been on the periphery of politics, and it moved directly into the mainstream. And I should also say that the Tet Offensive also eroded significantly the confidence of the people in South Vietnam, because most people in South Vietnam were not communists, nor were they necessarily supporters of the idea of a democratic republic. They were basically, I think, trying to stay alive and figure out who was going to win this thing, because whichever choice you made was a life and death matter. If you chose the wrong side, you could forfeit your life. So I think, understandably, many people were hedging their bets. And I think prior to Tet, the idea that the Saigon regime was being supported by the most powerful military force in the world probably gave people more confidence in the South Vietnamese government and in Saigon. But after the Tet Offensive, I think a lot of people, particularly those who were in areas like Hue that had been very hard hit by this fighting, doubted that Saigon was going to triumph in this battle. So I think it really eroded public confidence in the South Vietnamese government.
Mark Bowden, you've written an important book here, and there will be a movie, 10 parts. What would you want us to learn here?
First and foremost, I think it's valuable to understand what we demanded of the young Americans who we sent to Vietnam. The Battle of Hue was a hellacious and traumatic experience for those who fought. A movie about this would convey the extraordinary bravery of those who fought on both sides, but also the extent of the folly of the whole experiment. You know, the idea that you defeat the enemy and you win the war by destroying the thing that you're supposed to be protecting remains one of the lasting ironies of the whole experience.
Give us one Marine, Mark, in one moment in that awful battle at Hue.
I always remember Richard Leffler. Maybe that's because he's from Philadelphia and I was able to meet and get to know him. He was a 17-year-old tough kid from Conshohocken, in a neighborhood in northwest Philly. He had been sent to the Marine Corps in lieu of going to juvie. He'd been picked up by the police and the local magistrate said he needed to send him to juvenile detention or he'd put him in the Marine Corps. So Lefty, as they called him, became a Marine. He was introduced into the Battle of Hue in the middle of the battle at one of the worst possible moments. And within the first 10 minutes of his experience of the battle, he found himself trapped in a hole underground with the decaying dead remains of Vietnamese people who had been killed. He was terrified and trying to crawl out of this hole, but above him, the battle was raging with such intensity that he was too afraid to climb out. So he was curled in fetal position, as he put it, screaming for his mother, trapped between horror and fear. And to me, that experience of his told me a lot about the nature of battle and also the nature of America's involvement in Vietnam. So I think he's, to me, an example of a relatively innocent American who was forever changed by the United States' decision to pack him off to fight in Vietnam.
Mark Bowden seems to have interviewed every survivor for his account of Hue 1968. Coming up, the Pulitzer Prize historian of the French and American wars in Vietnam, Frederick Logoval. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Our guest, Frederick Logoval, is among the master historians of Vietnam and the West over a century now since the Versailles Treaty at the end of World War I that confirmed the French grip on Southeast Asia. Now at Harvard, Professor Logoval won the Pulitzer Prize for Embers of War and then highest praise again for a book called Choosing War, about first the French and then the American wars to hang on to Vietnam. Fred Logoval, welcome back. Hindsight, please, on the Tet Offensive and Hue.
Well, I it was really interesting to hear the Mark Bowden interview. It's a book that I admire in many ways. I think that he's a tremendous storyteller, as we already know, and I think he's got a terrific story to tell in this book about Hue 1968. And I'm not surprised to hear that it's going to be a television movie.
Do I hear a but coming?
Well, there is a but in the sense that I think, and I pointed this out in a review I wrote in the Washington Post, I think that it's not, in my judgment, correct to say that Tet and Hue changed the debate completely. In fact, it seems to me it'd be a better argument in a sense to argue that Tet changed much less about the debate in the United States about the course of the war in South Vietnam than we often suggest. Let's bear in mind, for example, 10,000 Americans died in 1967 in Vietnam. 10,000 Americans died in 69, first year of Nixon's administration. Both sides fought ferociously after Tet. There was disillusionment long before Tet in terms of American elite opinion and even general opinion. So, you know, it serves, I think, Mark Bowden's narrative purposes, obviously, to really emphasize the degree to which everything kind of changed as a result of Hue and Tet. I'm skeptical on that particular part of it.
I hear you, and it's a good point. We speak about a wake-up call, but the change was incredibly slow. And you could say that about the whole war 50 years later, in the sense of, did it change our profile in the world, or are we still doing the same thing?
We can. Let me just say one other thing. Your own reporting, Chris, if I may refer to this. You were there. You were there in the weeks before Tet. And what's interesting about those pieces in the Globe in the early part of January 1968 is the degree to which then, before Tet, the South Vietnamese people you spoke with didn't see a reason for optimism. They were not seeing that either Chu or Ki, the two key political figures in Saigon, were any real leaders to speak of. They didn't think the American involvement was really helping. That seems, again, to underscore this point that we should be careful about exaggerating what this extraordinary battle, and there's no question that it was, including in Hue, what it meant for the war as a whole.
Yeah, fascinating. There was a stalemate clear then, what JFK called their war. they said, no, it's become an American war, and were deeply disillusioned. But another way of looking at it, what can you judge about a war by the 50-year aftermath? Yeah. If you were looking at two countries, peasants in Asia, a huge industrial power here, and I said to you, those two countries were at war 50 years ago.
Yeah.
Can you judge today who won and what the war was like?
I don't know that you can. I mean, in certain respects, you could. It's extraordinary the degree to which Vietnam, a dictatorship to be sure.
Today. Yep.
Nevertheless, is in many respects a very vibrant country with a lot of young people. And there is a sense of energy there that I think anybody who visits will see. They made mistakes, the government, to be sure. They nevertheless, we should remember, took on first the French, defeated the French, then withstood the mighty power of the United States. And meanwhile, as you and I both know, in this country 50 years later, we face any number of problems pertaining to our democracy, the level of our political discourse, our foreign policy. I think the proverbial Martian who came down would find this a most interesting kind of comparison between the two countries.
No, it's amazing. You'd have to say they're still in character. Their constitutional character in endless wars with China over millennia, we know, they seem to have found themselves again in that role. We seem to be more confused. Interesting differences. I mean, hearings were held on Vietnam, thanks to Senator Fulbright, but the elite that took us into that awful war was never purged. There was no house cleaning. Our wars go on. Mary McCarthy made an amazingly sharp observation when the war was all over. She said, "Nothing is worse for a private person than to have seen in a moment of clarity the error of his ways and then failed to alter them. The last state of the man is worse than the first." What did we learn in practice?
Well, this is an amazing quote from McCarthy. I need to remember that with respect to my own kids, I think. in some ways, I think we did learn some things. I do think that Americans, if we focus on foreign policy, I think that American administrations after Vietnam, for a time at least, were more careful about entering into large-scale wars, limited wars, as they were called, far from America's shores. I do think that it had an effect for a time in that respect. I think many administrations have been wary about counterinsurgency, rightly so, since Vietnam. Hasn't stopped us from any number of interventions. So I wouldn't want to make too much of this point. But I also think to suggest that nothing changed as a result of Vietnam in foreign policy probably would be going a bit too far.
Well, there was a lurch back. I can see H.W. Bush, George H.W. Bush, left arm pumping whenever he was putting one over on you, saying, boasting, "We've licked the Vietnam syndrome. We're going into Iraq in the first Gulf War." And he got away with it.
Yeah, he did. And I think he got away with it in part because there was a desire, if I can put it that way, on the part of a great many of Americans, I won't by any means suggest all Americans, of course, but a great many Americans, to believe that at long last we had put this thing behind us. We had kicked this thing. Mm. And no longer would the ghosts of the war, you know, parade the halls of power in Washington. I think that, of course, was premature. I think in our political discourse, one of the things, I taught a class on Vietnam this past semester at Harvard, and I talked about the first class through the course and then at the end about the effects of the war, the lasting effects, I want to suggest, that the war's had on our, on the way we debate politics, on the way we think about government in our country. Mm. And that's something that, notwithstanding George H.W. Bush's assertion, we still have.
I want to come back to your class and what those kids know. They're two generations removed now from the experience. Yeah. But alongside Mary McCarthy's line, there was an amazing testimony from Norman Mailer at his best in 1975 when the war was over. He said, it has nothing to do with geopolitics or our place in the world. It has to do with getting our stuff together in this society, sort of to match the country that he loved growing up in the 30s. And he was talking about coming to grips with industrial pollution, the psychic pollution of suburban real estate overdevelopment. He said, with the buildings of the last 20 years, which have to be the worst architecture in the history of the world, with the packaging of food, may yet prove the most unhealthy food in the history of the world. I mean, he's talking about a Trumpified America 40 years before. He talks about the shriek zones of electronics and media glut. This was before the iPhone, for crying out loud. And he was saying, we have not even spoken of the lack of solution to civil rights, sexual rights, and the fast disappearing sense in every American of a neighborhood or any other route. We're bombed on future shock. This is Norman Mailer saying, let's start a reform campaign, clean up this country in its head and its streets and everything.
And it's 1975. I mean,
exactly.
That's an extraordinary thing. And I think, well, it speaks for itself. I'll just add that this assertion on his part that it's really about what's happening here at home. It's about our institutions and it's about what we're doing in American society. Mm. Just, it seems to me, has extraordinary lasting power, especially for me as a student of the war. And it's just ended when he says this. The war itself, it seems to me, has to be explained in large part because of domestic political imperatives that a succession of presidents felt and their advisors felt. So much of this, as he's suggesting, is really about us, and it's about American politics and society during the war. And he's suggesting in 75 after the war, and what he says, as you suggest, has this startling contemporary resonance.
Yeah, I mean, he's almost predicting, watch out, America, you're going to have a real estate, a luxury gold-plated developer in the White House if you don't watch out. But there's another whole piece of this that I just want to try out on you, that the public conversation through the Vietnam War was stronger then, certainly than it was in the Iraq War, and that it's getting weaker today in the United States, despite the Internet, or maybe because of the Internet. There were so many extraordinary media voices. Before we said media about everything, it was journalism and network news, but Cronkite above all. But there were many others. Halberstam, remarkably. Neil Sheehan, Malcolm Brown. I mean, it's very powerful to remember those names. Norman Mailer himself, I.F. Stone. There are no institutions that I can think of, in our world today, that there were citadels of free speech and you know, robust criticism.
Yeah, I think the journalism story is an extraordinary one. It's as you say, immensely powerful. One of the paper topics, one of the options that I gave my students in my class this past semester was to go back and look at the reporting by Neil Sheehan and David Halberstam. Why? Because they were Harvard alums. And Sheehan was actually a history major when he was there. Mm. They spent a lot of time at the Crimson. But I wanted the students to think about what Harvard graduates who became very prominent journalists cut their teeth, in a sense, in Vietnam, although Halberstam was also doing important reporting at home. But to give them an opportunity, if they wanted to, these students, to look at what they were actually writing from Vietnam, it's a great story. Several students took that paper option and looked up and did research on their writing from Vietnam, especially in 63, 64, in those key moments, key months, when these monumental decisions are being made.
Yeah, strangely, the Fourth Estate was a part of almost constitutional American life, and it was not the enemy, and it was not moralizing continually as it seems today. And then, of course, there was Cronkite himself.
Oh, yes.
And we've got to play a little of that famous editorial after he went to Vietnam to see the story after Tet.
To say that we are closer to victory today is to believe, in the face of the evidence, the optimists who have been wrong in the past. To suggest we are on the edge of defeat is to yield to unreasonable pessimism. To say that we are mired in stalemate seems the only realistic, if unsatisfactory, conclusion. On the off chance the military and political analysts are right, in the next few months we must test the enemy's intentions in case this is indeed his last big gasp before negotiations. But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could. This is Walter Cronkite. Good night.
That's amazing. Stalemate is, of course, what the Vietnamese told me. But when Walter Cronkite gave that editorial, Lyndon famously said, yep, if I've lost Walter Cronkite, I've lost the American people.
I mean, it's February 27th. Here he is, I think, the most respected, certainly newsman in the country, one of the most respected people in the country. And I read from that speech, and precisely the portion that you just played for us, I read to my students. And I just think the way it's written, Chris, if you look at the cadence, if you look at the rhythm of the writing, the word choice, I think is an extraordinary piece of writing coming from this man and who finishes by saying, people, honorable people who did the best they could. Now, we could debate, you and I could debate, well, did Americans really pledge to live up to this pledge to defend democracy in South Vietnam? Mm. We could have a debate about whether that's really true, but coming from him, a deeply patriotic man who, you know, America listened to on a nightly basis, I think it's one of the key moments of the war. No question.
You know, it's fascinating. It's contradictory, but there's a paradox here in the Trump era. The New York Times can suggest implicitly that American government before Trump was brilliant and heroic, consistently professional, serious, etc. You can also look back on the record. Robert McNamara, who was supposed to be the smartest man that ever lived, was a complete idiot about Vietnam. He did not know the terrain. He did not know the population. He did know nothing.
Well, I would just quibble a little bit with this in the sense that, in a sense, what's tragic about McNamara, I wrote about this recently, is that privately, and I don't think, by the way, this is to his credit what I'm about to say, privately he did know a great deal, and he despaired at what was happening. He didn't think the air war was going to be successful. He wondered and worried about his own complicity in all this. I think it's now clear. The problem was he didn't do anything about it. The problem was that he valued his White House parking spot, if you will, and his allegiance to the president over his duty to the country.
Do we know why he did it?
I think he's a very complex man. I think we await, by the way, his great biographer. If anybody's out there wanting to tackle McNamara, we need that book. But I think it was misplaced loyalty, ultimately.
But it was also that attachment to numbers and body counts. And that in retrospect, is pathological.
Yes.
Our friend, my hero, maybe yours, I.F. Stone, post-Tet, said, when the bodies are really counted, it'll be seen that one of the major casualties was our delusion about victory by air power. All that boom-boom did not keep the enemy from showing up at Lang Ve with tanks. And he was scathing about Westmoreland and McNamara. He said, on this body, oh, we won the body count. And Stone says, it's as if they mistake the art of warfare for the demolition and extermination business.
Yeah, and you know what's the thing about Stone, who we don't talk enough about, I would say.
The greatest journalist in my lifetime.
Is that if you go back and look at his reports in the weekly, you're seeing this in 63 and 64 from a very early point. This this extraordinary journalist could see through the expressions of bravado, of optimism, of determination.
Of morality.
Yeah, morality.
No, it's striking. Vietnam is certainly, and Tet is a point in the utter disenchantment of Americans with their government, broadly, I think.
Yeah.
Interesting, on the night of the Tet reports, when they suspended the, or held up the Johnny Carson show for 15 minutes to tell you the news, they said, now the official sources tell us, and that was Dan Rather's voice.
Yeah.
But that was a break point. People don't speak about official sources uncritically, and yet maybe we swallow them as never before.
Yeah, I wonder about that. And it's certainly true that we don't use that kind of language anymore. And that's one of the effects, it seems to me, of the war and of the reporting that is done and of the way that we Americans view, you know, the networks and what, shall we say, big-time reporters have to tell us about what's going on.
Right, and we're still pretty passive when we hear government reports about what's being accomplished or not by still more war, still more troops in Afghanistan. There was very little real second-guessing, I.F. Stone style, of predictions, forecasts in Iraq, the overall scheme of things, even the numbers. There are no body counts anymore.
No, it's really true. It's really true.
Public conversation, do you agree that there's something fishy about ours today?
I totally agree, yes.
Yeah. Coming up, the ironies, nothing but ironies, from a Vietnamese perspective, with their booming economy and their dictatorial politics. From one way of looking at it, it's everything the Americans dreamed of for Vietnam all along. With Professor Fred Logoval, this is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The Vietnamese and now Californian writer Duong Van Mai Elliott has a long family history as complex as the politics of Vietnam at war. And she brought it all to one of the most admired looks back on years of hard experience. Her sister had fought with the communist Viet Minh in the 60s, never reconciled with her parents, who had worked in the French colonial bureaucracy since the 20s. Mai Elliott herself had grown up in both Hanoi and Saigon, then went to the U.S. for college. Back home as the war got hot, she had a job with the RAND Corporation for the Pentagon, interviewing North Vietnamese and Viet Cong prisoners about their values and motivations.
Well, I was just a newly minted graduate from Georgetown University. I had spent all my life in French schools, you know, learning more about France than about Vietnam. And I was a refugee from North Vietnam. I knew nothing about the South Vietnamese countryside. So RAND was doing a study commissioned by the Defense Department. McNamara was the defense secretary at the time, was the person who asked the question,
right,
who were the Viet Cong? Because people thought that the Americans would defeat this kind of fledgling insurgency very quickly, and yet the Viet Cong were not giving up, and they were actually winning the war at the time. So I was hired as an interviewer and an interpreter because I was bilingual. That was my only qualification because I knew nothing about communism. I knew nothing about why the insurgency happened.
If I may say, you knew more than McNamara did. McNamara said in a hearing before Congress that there were three times as many Catholics as Buddhists in South Vietnam, and that that the Buddhists constituted only 10% of the population. The man who knew everything was completely wrong on basic facts. You knew better.
Yeah, he knew nothing about the Viet Cong, but he wasn't the only one. A lot of Americans in policy positions didn't know anything about them, very little about them.
What did you learn?
Well, when I did the interview, and this was in early 65, and the Viet Cong at that time enjoyed a lot of support in the countryside mainly because of this legacy of the Viet Minh, the people who want the war against the French and free the country. So they still enjoy that aura of nationalism. And they were also feeding on the grievances in the countryside. As one of them explained to me, they joined to fight for what they call the just cause. They wanted to reunify the country. They thought the division at the 17th parallel was like a gash across Vietnam. Mm. They want to erase it. They want to reunify the country under a government that would bring them justice and equality. Also, they believed that the Americans were the new colonialists. So they felt they had to fight to get rid of these foreigners. So those were the reasons that were the strong motivators for a lot of them. That opened my eyes. You know, before I began, I thought, you know, these peasants didn't know what they were doing. But when I talked to them, I understood that, you know, they knew exactly what they were doing and what they wanted to see for their community, for themselves, for their families.
Were you in a position to tell anybody, hey, guys, you got it wrong? No, they have a cause here. There's a history.
Yes. Well, actually, the first report by the RAND team, headed at the time by two professors, and they wrote this report that said that the other side was very highly committed and it would be very tough to fight them. And they had what they call at their core this strong group of cadres who had fought against the French and had a lot of war experience and also was strongly committed to their cause. So they presented that to the people at the Defense Department. And I think the highest level they reached was John McNaughton, who was then the Assistant Secretary of Defense to McNamara. And apparently McNaughton said to the briefers, the two professors, if what you say is true, we're fighting on the wrong side, the side that is going to lose this war. So they did tell the people in power in Washington, but by that time, policy had already been set in place, you know.
Still amazing that the peasants won against those helicopters, those bombers, that napalm, endless explosive power, and the peasants won. Poor people.
Yeah, incredible that they could have withstood all that onslaught of American firepower. I personally don't know how they did it, but they were so highly motivated, I think. It's their country. They live there. They had to fight to survive, and, you know, they couldn't go anywhere else. Mm. You know, the Americans, if things got tough, they could pack up and go, leave. But, you know, those people, those peasants, they had to cling to their land. They had to cling to their homes. And they felt they had no choice but to fight in order to survive. It's just in our tradition, you know, fighting the foreigners who come in and try to take over our country and tell us what to do. It's just part of our history. I don't think people think much about it. As they say, when the invaders come to your door, you have to fight back.
What difference does it make in hindsight that you had served with the French or that your father had been a bureaucrat in the occupying government or not? Are you marked as somebody who worked with the American government, the RAND Corporation of all people?
No, right now it doesn't matter. I mean, I go back a lot, and that has never been held against me. The stigma, if you will, from the perspective of the other side, has gone away. When I go back, you know, nobody asks me about it. Even if I talk about it, nobody feels that it's something amiss. But for some Vietnamese who lived through the war, the memory is still very vivid. They don't talk about it, but it doesn't mean they don't remember it. In the case of my relatives, for example, who were in North Vietnam during the war, I had to prod them to talk about it. But when they get going, it comes back and they can become very emotional. But on a daily basis, they don't think about it. And in the case of in my family, my oldest brother doesn't want to go back because at the end of the war, he was thrown in a camp the communists call it a re-education camp. And he was in the camp for like 5 years. And even though he was not executed or killed or tortured or anything, he was held as a prisoner in this camp. And the goal of the communists was to indoctrinate people, because they felt that those who had worked for the South Vietnamese government had been inculcated with wrong thinking. And now this thinking had to be replaced with new thinking about socialism. So his resentment is still pretty strong, because he felt he had done nothing wrong. Mm. And yet they kept him imprisoned in this former orphanage near Saigon for 5 years.
Would you feel comfortable walking down the street in Hanoi or Saigon today?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I do that all the time when I go back. The beautiful thing is that my relatives in North Vietnam, you know, welcome me back. They, you know, it's as if nothing had happened in between. Mm. The communist revolution hadn't happened. The war against the French hadn't happened. The Vietnam War hadn't happened. We're just relatives. And so when I go back, you know, they would take me back to our ancestral village near Hanoi, and we would go through all the rituals, we're worshiping our ancestors and so on. And that's the amazing thing about Vietnamese culture, is that the old customs and the tradition die hard. And these, my cousins, grew up under communism, and yet once the prohibition against worshiping ancestors or going to temples and pagodas, you know, religious belief was lifted, I mean, they just picked up the old customs like if nothing had happened, you know. So they actually remember better all the customs than I do. Mm. And so when I go back, you know, they take me back to the village, and we went to all the tombs, all the graves. They brought all the offerings, and they burned incense. And then we ate together in the ancestral hall. And, you know, it was just, like I said, as if nothing had happened. I think the ancestors probably believe that that's just the course of history. It's what they call, they say, choi ding. That means that heavens has decreed that this has happened. Heavens have a plan that unfolds, and there's nothing much you can do to change it. So all the bad things, that the tragedy that happens in Vietnam, perhaps it was part of the plan of heaven. And sometimes the plan is favorable and sometimes it's not, but you don't know when this is going to happen. So you just have to take it as it comes and do the best you can to surmount it.
My Elliott's scrupulously researched and remembered memoir was called The Sacred Willow. It was published by Oxford University Press 25 years after the fighting stopped. Back to you, historian Fred Logaball. Quick point. But these things dawn on you so slowly. We never knew why Ho Chi Minh had so much secret support in that country, communist or whatever. It was because he'd beaten the French in 1954. That simple. He got rid of the occupier, and he'll do it again.
I think it gave him and his revolution enormous credibility in the countryside, and indeed in the urban areas, and also that they had helped thwart the Japanese. So in World War II... Mm. When Indochina was under de facto Japanese control, it was the Viet Minh under Ho that did the lion's share, if you will, of
Absolutely.
Opposing the Japanese. So that, too, gave him a kind of legitimacy, to use a loaded word, that the non-communists just could never achieve.
Bigger point about my Elliott's amazing picture of Vietnam as if nothing had happened. Is that a veneer? Is it real? Is it some Asiatic mystery that we don't, you know, life goes on. We're not grudge-ridden as we tend to be in Iran, for example.
Well, I wonder about that when I go to Vietnam, because I totally see what she's saying, and I can't see it in the way she says it because I'm not Vietnamese. My Elliott is clearly one of our most astute observers of all this, but I see it too when I go. Maybe some of it has to do with the fact that when you're the victor, it's a little easier to sort of put it behind you or to move ahead. And it's also a very young country if you go. You realize that for the vast majority of Vietnamese, they have no memory of this and haven't for a long time. But I think she's spot on in that observation.
As I was listening to it just now, again, it just struck me a fascinating question. Is China taking a big place in the world now, a giant place, going to be so stoical or just forgetful or forgiving or whatever about its century of oppression by the same imperial powers, especially Britain and France, and to some extent the U.S.?
That's a really interesting question. I don't know the answer. It's at least plausible. How's that for a cop-out observation? But I wonder. I do.
No, but I mean, we hold grudges, and maybe it's a perfectly human thing to do, but maybe the Chinese don't.
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, you know, there are very important differences. Historians of the two countries will tell you, the Vietnamese and the Chinese, to be sure. But there may be something here, as you're suggesting, in which the Chinese, as they achieve the kind of success and the kind of might and the kind of power that they're currently amassing, will find it likewise pretty easy to waive, to dismiss, to swallow those grudges.
Hmm.
I wonder.
Take us back to your classroom,
yeah,
Fred, with kids whose grandparents lived through,
yeah,
Vietnam. What do they think it suggests about who we are, what we do, what we should do?
I found the students to be deeply impressive as a group, and they were really interested in the subject matter. I think that Vietnam, maybe it's because of the music, maybe it's because of the movies, maybe it's because of some kind of cultural imprint. But Vietnam, even for today's 19 and 20-year-olds, holds a particular interest. I mean, they're just interested in this stuff. I think they were hungry to learn about the war. I told them on the first day, we're going to study this war as history. I want you to understand by the end of this semester what happened and why, or at least come closer to answering those questions. But then I also said, in the process of doing this, my hope is that we can also learn something about ourselves, learn something about our present moment. I suggested to them that a lot of the troubles that plague us as a society, the resentment, the cynicism, the mistrust of government, the mistrust of our institutions, the tendency we have today to always question one another's motives. I said to them that I won't claim that Vietnam is responsible for all of this by any means, but I do think that the war planted seeds or at least furthered, worsened these tendencies. And I think in that respect, it underscores for me, I suggested to the students, why we need to study this war and we need to learn from it. And in particular with respect to the cynicism, because I suggested to them that the cynicism is very corrosive to our democracy, to our belief or our lack of belief in government, and Vietnam is key to that problem.
What do they know? What do they want to know about the resistance, which was a formidable force unto itself? People making choices, protesting, at, you know, year after year, going to Canada, changing their lives, and in some fashion succeeding.
I think they're very interested in that. I'm not sure that if you were to take the group as a whole, it was about 70 students. Were they more interested in the opposition, in the resistance, than they were in the war itself and the decision-making, the military side? Maybe not. But they certainly were very keen to talk about this. I assigned in the class the things they carried by Tim O'Brien. And the TAs told me that the discussion in section about that book, which is about those who went to Vietnam and also those who were fearful of going, it's an extraordinary book. And deeply impassioned discussion about precisely those questions, those points that you just raised, Chris.
You know, we want to track in months coming up, not every week, but a variety of effects.
Yeah.
You know, on our movies, for example. Our movies darkened.
No question.
Not just the Vietnam ones, but effects on sports, on race reality
music.
And understanding. Yeah. Music, definitely. Norman Mailer wanted us 40 years ago to wake up to our gender, sexual liberties and relationships.
Well,
where would you point us?
So maybe this is not quite on point, but I do want to just say something about the music. We could talk about the legacy in music, but the music of the Vietnam era. One of the things I did in class is I started each class by playing a song from that era. So I had Marvin Gaye, I had Dylan, I had the Stones, I had John Lennon. And you think about how extraordinary the Vietnam era music was. Mm. I mean, Rolling Stone had the top 500 songs.
Sympathy for the Devil.
Almost all of them. Seven out of the top 10 were Vietnam era songs. It's an amazing legacy.
Fred Logaval, thank you. I wish we heard from you every week. Maybe we will someday. Thanks very much to Mark Bowden and Mai Elliott. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DiGregorio, and our resident artist, Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our good general. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.